Welcome to Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. As the Silver City Farmers Market kicks off its 2016 season this Saturday, May 14th, I can't help but think about pollinators. The butterflies, bees, bats, beetles, flies, and hummingbirds that help pollinate over 75% of our flowering plants and nearly 75% of our crops. Without these animals, we wouldn't have many fruits, vegetables, and nuts, as well as chocolate and coffee, all of which rely on pollinators. Habitat loss, pesticide use, and other factors threaten our pollinators that in turn threaten our food security, food sources for wildlife, and the health of our ecosystems. With me today live in the Gila Members Community Radio studio to talk about pollinators and discuss how we can help out pollinators and mitigate threats to these important animals is Tricia Hurley, co-owner with her husband, Mark Cantrell, of Lone Mountain Natives Nursery here in Silver City. Good morning, Tricia.
Good morning.
Well, Tricia, thanks for being here. And the arc of your career is so interesting to me. You started your career as a wildlife biologist, and now you and your husband own Lone Mountain Natives. How did you start Lone Mountain Natives?
Well, that's a good story because, of course, it all goes back to pollinators. So I was a wildlife biologist. I worked for the Forest Service and Arizona Game and Fish for many years, and we moved to Silver City because when we decided to start a family, I wanted to be home with the kids, basically. And as a wildlife biologist, I was gone all the time. So we moved to Silver City. My husband is a school teacher, but he has a background in wildlife biology, and he's Mr. Green Thumb that got me started in all of this. So when we moved here, he started teaching at Jose Barrios Elementary. And Mark and I, when the kids were very young, this was in 2005, we had written a couple grants to start a pollination garden at Jose Barrios Elementary School. And one of the grants was from PNM, and the other grant was from New Mexico Game and Fish, their Share with Wildlife program, which Audubon helped us get that one. And anyway, to make a long story short, we started this lovely pollination garden there in the shape of a butterfly. And in so doing that, we were visiting Tom Lynch, who owned at the time Quality Native Plants. I think that's what his business name was. And he sold at the farmer's market, and we were getting a lot of our plants from him as well as other sources. So it just happened to turn out that Martha Carter, who many of you know her name, called us to let us know that she'd heard Tom Lynch was going out of business.
She was with Native Plant Society when she and Dr. Jack Carter lived here in Silver City.
Yes, and they've written numerous books, as hopefully many people are familiar with, on identifying a lot of the native plants from this area. So she had given us a call to let us know that Tom Lynch was going out of business and wanted to sell all the rest of his plants. So one thing led to another, and we bought the rest of Tom's 750 plants. That was, you know, a good 10, 11 years ago, and we moved so we could have a nursery space that we needed with greenhouses and hoop houses, and we've been doing it ever since.
And you all grow native plants. You collect seed. And
yes. We actually, this columbine is a good example. Some of the native plants are difficult to start from seed. This golden columbine, which is in full bloom right now on the table here, the seed is collected by us every year, and you have to cold stratify it. We actually start these in the greenhouse in January, and we sprinkle the seed in little tiny 4-inch pots, and then we water them every day, and nothing happens for the longest time, and then at the end of February, suddenly we have little tiny columbines germinating. So a lot of the plants do need what we call cold stratification. We do collect a lot of the seed ourselves. We also work with plants of the Southwest to get seed that we can't get.
Okay, well, let's return back to pollinators and let's talk basics. What is pollination and what are pollinators?
Yes. So the basics, what is pollination? Pollination is simply moving pollen from one flower to another flower of the same species. And that is how, you know, we're going to get the seed or the fruit from our flower. Some plants are self-pollinating, but most of them are not. And most of our plants are relying on mostly insects, hummingbirds, and a few animals also pollinate, or mammals, I should say. So that's what pollination is, and that's why we should care. That's why it's so important.
Yeah, and what are types of pollinators? Because I think most people just think butterflies and bees, but actually,
yeah,
birds?
Yeah. You know, the most important pollinators are the insects. Hummingbirds do pollinate plants, but the significant pollination is done by insects. And so many of us, me included, are pretty illiterate when it comes to insects. We have one plant at our house called fern bush, which is a native bush that grows in the Southwest, and it attracts so many diverse pollinators. I go outside and just stare at it in the summer, and there's iridescent beetles and sweat bees and wasps and all kinds of stuff on these flowers that I don't even know what they are. They're so numerous. So there's a lot of different kinds of pollinators. And, you know, we often think of the butterflies and the bees. But they're kind of a spokesanimal for the rest of the pollinators that are struggling. And pollinators are a keystone species. All of the other animals, including humans, are dependent upon the activity, what they provide. You know, the food that we get, animals that eat the berries, the bears that, you know, need the berries in order to survive, the people, our crop pollination. So they're a keystone species. All pollinators are. But the public tends to focus on, you know, the big ones in the news, and we forget that there's numerous pollinators out there.
So one, I was reading a little bit in preparation for today, and our white-winged dove here in New Mexico is a really important pollinator for the saguaro cactus in the Sonoran Desert, which I never would have known. So here,
I didn't know that either.
So here's a species that we see all over the place here in New Mexico, but very critical to saguaro pollination over in Arizona.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because when we do talk about the plants, one thing I've sort of left out is the yuccas and the succulents, and they're very important pollinator. Well, they're pollinated by moths and bats, and that's a very important thing that is often overlooked.
So bats, let's talk what bats are pollinators.
Yeah, bats are pollinators for a lot of the night-blooming
plants. Yeah,
or, you know, things that open at the crepuscular hours, mostly the evening
hours. Sounds creepy, crepuscular hours. Okay, so let's, you know, you mentioned this already, that your fern bush attracts all of these pollinators. And let's talk a little bit more about pollinators and their importance. I mean, crops, but also ecosystems, right? I mean, that's what is keeping ecosystems healthy, food for wildlife.
Yeah.
Let's just talk a little bit more in detail about the importance of pollinators and in terms of crops, in terms of...
So I think you already mentioned that our food, I think it's about one third of our food is produced because of the pollination that's happening. So, of course, that's very important. And then I believe it's 75% of all plants rely on pollinators. Because, you know, there is wind pollination and other things like that. But at least 75% of all plants rely on pollinators. So to keep our ecosystems going and healthy and reproducing, we obviously need pollinators.
And also native plants for pollination, right?
I mean,
that's pretty key.
And that's one thing I would like to touch upon in more detail, and we'll come back to it further along in the conversation. But the important thing to remember is that pollinators have evolved with the native plants that we have here. So it's always a good idea to try to choose native plants if you're wanting to help the pollinators.
And what are some of the threats? Let's just talk generally, and we're going to get into more detail later in the show, but give people an overview of what are some of the threats to pollinators? We hear a lot about monarchs, but as you've already pointed out, you know, it's not just monarch butterflies and the honeybees. Yeah. It's much broader.
So the biggest threat is the habitat loss and fragmentation of habitat. That would be the biggest threat. Certainly pesticides are a large threat, although the pesticides companies would have you believe otherwise. But if you go to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Xerces Society and a lot of these other groups, you will see pesticides listed as a main threat. Some of the other threats that you might not think about, one that I hadn't thought about, is light pollution, you know, especially for our nighttime pollinators. So let's see, what are some of the other threats that we have researched? I would like to mention that, you know, we think of the farmland, of course, as a threat because it has taken habitat. But something to remember about the farmland, too, is that it can coexist and provide habitat. It used to be that there were more native plants planted along the edges of the farmland and things like that that would help. And then I'd like to counter that with thinking about suburban and urban areas. We have a lot of pesticide use in our towns. And that is a great, great threat to the pollinators.
Yeah, and we're going to talk more about that as we go along in the show. And before we break after this first segment, let's just talk a little bit more about native plants and why are native plants important to pollinator survival?
We had just started to talk about that. So I was hoping to talk some more about natives versus non-natives. Again, the native plants have evolved with the pollinators, and a lot of the pollinators feed on very specific plant species. So you're going to want to choose native plants because of that. Non-native plants, they may not provide enough nectar or pollen, and they might not be edible to a lot of the larval stages of, say, the butterflies and things like that. One thing I want to warn people, too, with is a lot of people just see a lot of these bedding plants that are, you know, Albertsons has a whole bunch outside of Albertsons right now, Walmart. A lot of the big box stores are selling a lot of very attractive looking flowery bedding plants. And there's a lot of ornamentals and things they've done, hybrids they've done, or ornamentals with double flowers and things like that. And people should just realize that a lot of those plants may not provide enough pollen or nectar. You know, they're very showy, but they're lacking in genetic diversity. They're lacking in nutrients that a lot of the pollinators may need. The other thing about some of those bedding plants is they have been broadcast sprayed with systemic pesticides. And a systemic pesticide is something we'll talk about further in, but it's a pesticide that is taken up by the whole plant and persists.
All right, we'll be right back here on Earth Matters after this short break. We'll continue our discussion about pollinators with Tricia Hurley of Lone Mountain Native. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. My guest today is Tricia Hurley, co-owner of Lone Mountain Natives here in Silver City. And we've been talking about the importance of pollinators to our food security and to ecosystem health. So, Tricia, let's talk a little bit more in more detail about habitat loss and how that habitat loss is affecting pollinators. And we and like you said, we have a lot of different pollinators.
Okay. Well, I mean, habitat loss is a pretty easy concept. If there's no plants there, there's no nectar, and there's no pollen. So the problems with habitat loss or where habitat loss comes from is what we can look at. Certainly degradation of habitat, for example, overgrazing is a good example, or cropland and farmland, where in the Midwest, vast areas have been turned into crops and, you know, replaced many of the native plants. Fragmentation of habitat is a really important thing, too. We used to have, you know, sprinklings of habitat that would connect, like you talk about corridors. And certainly that's something we can reestablish. We can try to reestablish corridors so that when you have cropland, you have some edge woodland or edge patchy pollinator habitat that connects throughout. Those are some things we could do to help.
And fragmentation is important. Let's talk about how it affects pollinators, because it might not necessarily be obvious, but if our habitat gets, little patches of habitat get farther and farther apart, harder for pollinators to get from one patch of food to the next, and they get weakened, right?
Right. They need that food to be close by. They can't travel miles and miles and miles to get to the food. So fragmentation, you know, for birds, fragmentation brings up a lot of other problems, like some people maybe have heard of the edge effect. An increasing number of predators will be found on the edge of a habitat that's been fragmented. And predators are a problem for the birds then if you've got more possums and raccoons and whatnot eating bird eggs and snakes. I'm sure that some of these are going to be the same problems for the pollinators as well. So traveling distance time, not having the food, the nectar, the pollen readily available, as well as an increase of predators and as well as an increase in pesticides. Because if we're talking about fragmented cropland, we're also talking about runoff of pesticides. Or if we're talking about fragmentation with suburban neighborhoods expanding out, we're still talking about pesticides, because a lot of people have lawns or other things that they're using pesticides for, and they're running off into, you know, the neighborhoods, or they're just on the lawn or in an adjacent area where pollinators are foraging.
Yeah, what about for bats? We've heard a lot about bats being under threat. What's the situation with bats?
Well, so one of the problems with bats is the white nose syndrome. And I don't actually know a whole lot about that. I know that it's a problem, but I don't know what's causing it. I'm not sure. Do you know anything, Allison?
Yeah, I think they've said a fungus.
But I mean, I don't know what's causing the fungus.
Yes. Right. And in terms of habitat loss, I mean, in terms of bats, I mean, it just...
Certainly not having the food is a pretty obvious problem. So habitat loss speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, just not having the food is going to be a problem for these animals. There's also evidence of just weakened immune systems for the pollinators and the bats. And again, some of this can go back to pesticides.
Right.
Being responsible for weakened immune systems.
Well, that's a good segue, Tricia. You've just introduced kind of the next topic we want to talk about, and pesticide use. So first is habitat loss, big threat to pollinators. But the second is pesticide use. And of course, we've heard a lot of the potential relationship between pesticide use and colony collapse disorder in honeybees. Talk more about this. Honeybees are really responsible for pollinating close to $20 billion worth of crops every year.
Yes.
So pretty important.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that too, but I also want to point out that our native bumblebees are very, very important too, and they're often overlooked because I think so much attention goes to, you know, the honeybees, and like I think I said before, the monarch butterfly and the honeybees are in the news a lot. Anything we do to help honeybees is going to help all the other pollinators too. A lot of bumblebees pollinate crops as well. And I also want to point out that since we are having these issues with our European honeybee, that it's very important to support the local native bee population because they are responsible for pollinating many, many crops. And it's been pointed out in research that they actually pollinate many crops better. They're able to forage on inclement weather where honeybees will just hang out in the hive and they don't want to go out. You know, it's cold out, it's rainy, they don't want to go out. The native bumblebees forage at those times. They're one of the earliest ones to be active in the spring before honeybees would be active.
One thing that people might not realize is that honeybees are non-natives. You mentioned European.
Yeah.
So they're European species. So really the native pollinators can pick up the slack, so to speak.
Exactly, where that's what I'm trying to point out.
When
yes.
when the European species...
And, you know, our European honeybee is still having problems. And so it's important to help both of them. And yeah, the native bumblebee does do a lot of pollination for our crops.
So what is the story with pesticide use and colony collapse disorder? We hear a lot in the news about the link between Roundup and the decline in bee populations. And Tricia, you've done a lot of research on this. And what can you tell us? Where are things at?
Well, let's first just mention what the maybe colony collapse disorder is. What the researchers have discovered is that there's a variety of problems. There's a variety of things contributing to the colony collapse disorder. One of those things would be fungal parasites, mites that, you know, prey upon in the beehive, viral bacteria, and beekeeping practices. You know, moving the beehives constantly is going to be stressful for the
right bees.
But a lot of these fungal parasites, bacterial and viral problems are big problems. Now, the pesticide companies will have you believe that their pesticides, if used safely, are not causing a problem, but they are causing a problem. They're making the bees' immune systems and the bees just more susceptible to all of these other problems that I've just mentioned. What I find rather insidious is if you go and research the colony collapse disorder, you're going to see that a lot of these pesticide companies are spinning the story. They're co-opting researchers, they're funding researchers, they're trying to portray themselves as being bee-friendly. And they do have websites that you can go to. And the crazy thing is you read about it and they're doing a lot of good education about honeybees. They've got all the science there, right? But they're downplaying and not mentioning the role that pesticides play in the harm to native pollinators and to the European honeybee.
So in your research, you've found there is, you know, a lot of research supports the relationship between the use of neonicotinoid pesticides and decline in bee species.
So the neonics are, as I mentioned earlier, they're a really important one to talk about. And it is the three companies who make neonics that are portraying themselves as bee-friendly. And all the research says that the neonicotinoids are very harmful to the honeybee as well as all other pollinators. Neonicotinoids are taken up by the whole plant. So if, you know, you want to plant a pollination garden and you buy one of those bedding plants I mentioned earlier and put it in your garden thinking you're helping the pollinators, that actual pollen or nectar can have a lethal effect on a pollinator that's coming to that flower. So the neonicotinoids, they've shown, will persist in the soil for many, many years. And of course, they are taken up, as I said, by the whole plant. So they're really trying to downplay because they're making a lot of money off of these pesticides. They are harmful, and I would just warn everybody to read your labels. And I would hope that people just would choose not to use pesticides, but they're readily available. I also want to point out that Europe has banned the use of neonicotinoids.
So, and even if you're buying a plant, say bedding plants, they may be treated with these pesticides, so you don't actually really know. Is that right?
I would encourage people to ask the garden center, or if it's at a big box store, I would encourage people to go and ask if they know whether or not their plants have been treated with neonicotinoids. You know, there are other pesticides to worry about too, but what makes neonicotinoids so insidious is that it is taken up by the whole plant and can persist in the soil. So I would encourage people to ask, and that's a good pressure it puts on the industry so that they have to label the plants, or they, you know, it puts pressure on the wholesalers to find alternatives.
Yeah, so one thing, farmers market, we've got a number of local growers like Lone Mountain Natives and Mimbrus Farms and others that are not using these types of pesticides on their plants. So
yeah,
can you talk about
so,
that?
Well, I would encourage people to seek Mimbrus Farms out. I would encourage people to seek out Gavin. He sells plants at Farmer's Market. High Country Gals is the nursery that took over Steve and Regina's Silver Heights. I know she grows a lot of her own stuff. So, you know, seek those folks out and talk to them. And we can go into alternatives to pesticides later, because Allison, I think you were going to touch upon that.
Right.
And I do have some alternatives to discuss.
Right. So in the last couple minutes in this segment, you know, Tricia, you talked about that we spend a lot of our time focused on sort of these beautiful charismatic species like the monarch butterfly, but really these species are like the canary in the coal mine, sort of indicating a much larger problem. So can you expand on that just a little bit before we close for this second segment?
I just mostly mean that many pollinators are struggling, and it's just easy for the media to focus on, like, the butterflies, because everybody loves butterflies. They're so charismatic and enlightening to watch. So I just think that we should remember that the butterfly and the bees are the spokes animal for all the other pollinators that are dealing with the same issues that these keystone or species that are in the media so much are dealing with. So, yeah, I just want people to think about all the pollinators. And we're going to talk more, I hope, in the next segment about habitat and how to create the right kind of habitat.
Absolutely. So as we take a short break, we will come back and talk about what we can do to create pollinator-friendly habitat. So stay tuned here on Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. Welcome back to Earth Matters. This is Allison Sibbick, Director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. And we're talking about pollinators with Tricia Hurley, co-owner of Lone Mountain Natives. And we've been talking about all the problems and threats to pollinators. And in this segment, we'd like to talk about what you can do to create pollinator-friendly gardens and really help to support our native pollinators. So it's appropriate that we're having this discussion today, Tricia, because Saturday the farmers market starts.
Yes.
So opening day, Saturday, May 14th at 8:30, right?
Yes, and I think it's finally a good time for it to start because it's been an awfully cold April and May. Has anybody else noticed that?
That's right.
And windy.
Yeah, so when people head on down to the farmers market on Saturday, what should we be looking for to create pollinator-friendly backyard habitats?
This is where I could just go on and on, so you might have to, like, watch my time. So it's best to think native, and creating pollinator habitat or patches. I like people to think in patches because we all live in town, you know, so we're going to have to think in patches. What you want to think about is having many different species, many different types of plants that can provide nectar and pollen throughout the growing season. So you don't want to just plant heavily for the middle of the summer or the middle of the spring. You want to have things staggered so you have several plants blooming at each period or time of the growing season. You also want to remember to plant trees, shrubs, and perennials. Like a lot of people, I think, just think, oh, flowers, flowers, flowers. I'm going to plant lots of flowers and perennials. But you want to think of the trees and shrubs too, because they're going to give canopy height. They're going to give structure to foraging insects. You know, you're going to have the height, different canopies. They're going to be able to seek shelter in the trees. A lot of the trees are also host plants for the larval stages of the insects. So again, you don't want to just plant, you know, from one group, but across the spectrum, different flowering times and different types of plants in those categories. And earlier I mentioned, I always forget to mention the cacti and the yucca.
Right, right.
They're just as important. I keep saying shrubs and trees, but the cacti and yucca are important to incorporate. And again, that structural diversity and habitat is very important for insects. So they have different foraging heights. A lot of them will require differences there, and that they have shelter from the wind, from predators, etc., from inclement weather, wind.
Right.
Has anybody noticed the wind lately? So you also want to plant several of the same species if you can. Of course, space is a limitation. So, you know, maybe you can't plant, like chokecherry is a great tree to plant. But, you know, your yard can only handle so many chokecherries. So at least incorporate one of those and maybe two shrubs. And then you can go crazy if you don't have as much space with, you know, the columbines that are here on the table and the coral bells and the smaller things that are going to provide a lot of nectar.
Okay.
And I've got more to say, but I'll.
Yeah. So what are some of the different species?
Okay.
I mean, we have a beautiful yellow columbine here on the table, which I wish people could see, and a coral bell. And what is this? This looks like.
Oh, rub the leaf and smell that. That's one of the native mints, and it's an agastache.
Okay. And is that the red blooming one or the purple one?
This is a purple one. It's called Oregon Mountain Hyssop. It's actually a rare plant in the Oregon Mountains. It's more common in Mexico. Did you smell it?
Yeah.
It has a real licorice-y smell, and you can eat it. It gets a purple flower on it that pollinators come to very late in the fall. And even though it's a lavender or purple flower, the hummingbirds come to it like mad in October. And I think it's because in late October, nothing else is blooming. But what I wanted to point out with this one is to show that many of these native plants, not only are they important for pollinators, but they're medicinal or they're edible. They have other attributes that we need to take into consideration that are great benefits.
Right. So what are some of, like, so here we are spring, I guess it's late spring, but what are some of the spring blooming plants that people could get a hold of?
Certainly the columbine.
Okay.
And a lot of bees come to columbine. I actually saw a hummingbird come to one of our columbines the other day. We had hummingbirds coming to our western white honeysuckle, like profusely.
Right.
And that's another yellow flower.
And very good for birds. I mean, I still have berries on mine from last year, and the birds, the migrating birds right now,
are going for
going
the berries.
For the
Excellent.
Berries.
And of course, the bees are all over the western white honeysuckle, which should be in full bloom right now. I know ours is. So western white honeysuckle, columbine, certainly the other thing that's in full bloom right now are the penstemons.
Okay.
And penstemons are special value to bees as well as the hummingbirds. So let's see, what are some of the other ones that
what
are
about
blooming
some shrubs?
Right now?
What about some
a
shrubs?
A lot of the currants
and
the chokecherries, those hop tree, these are all things that should be blooming. Either they already did or they will. The Rus trilobata is something that blooms, that's three-leaf sumac, that blooms very early. So a lot of the shrubs are, you know, going to be blooming right now as well.
So what about summer flowering?
So summer,
plants in the summer?
Oh, I should mention Findler sundrops, though, because some people will have noticed that's blooming along the roadside, out at Kirkland Road and along 180, low-mounding primroses, yellows, and they're blooming right now. Special value to bees as well as the moths that will come to them. So for summer, the things that come to my mind are the yarrow. Yarrow is blooming right now, too. I brought one of those. So yarrow is a spring, summer, kind of all-season bloomer. And western white yarrow is a really important pollination plant for a lot of different insects. I would encourage people to plant the western white yarrow because a lot of what we see are these ornamental yarrows, the paprika red one and the yellow one, and they're not as beneficial to the pollinators as the western white yarrow is. Okay, so for summer, a lot of the milkweeds, the asclepias, The horsetail milkweed is a little known one that I'd like to talk about more about, like, you know, mowing and stuff like that. Maybe we can touch upon that later. Maximilian sunflower is a great one for bees. The native buckwheats, we have a lot of eriogonums, or native buckwheats are very important for bees. And the late fall, some of the ones that come to mind are, of course, well, I should have said Maximilian sunflower because that's really late fall, but the goldenrods. We have a native goldenrod we've been growing and cultivating for years, a local native that grows around here called Wright's goldenrod. And I tell you, it is covered in hundreds of bees at our house.
And also the chamisa, right, in the fall?
The chamisa, not so much for the bees, but
the
for
butterflies.
The chamisa is a very, very important one. Four-winged saltbush is an important one, too. But the chamisa, everybody loves to watch the chamisa in the fall. It's just hopping with butterflies.
So one thing I've noticed planting native plants in my yard is you can get just as much color and beauty from native plants as you can with, you know, sort of the bedding ornamentals.
Yes, and a lot of the ornamentals.
So,
and in a way, I mean, it's okay to incorporate those, but people need to realize they're a little bit like an artificial plant, because incorporating so many bedding plants and annuals that are so full of showy color, many of them are not providing any nectar or pollen. And if they are, it's very insignificant amounts. So,
right. And people might notice that hummingbirds or bees and butterflies might not even really go to those plants in the first place.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
certainly
one
you're gonna
thing
notice.
I've noticed.
Yeah, yeah. So I do want to mention a couple other shrubs, because you had brought up like the rabbit brush, but a couple others are the false indigo. That's a really important one for anybody that's been hiking along the Gila River. When that's in bloom, it's just covered in butterflies and various pollinators. The cliff findler bush, if anybody's been out hiking lately in the south of Tyrone, we've got our
the burrows.
The burrows. The cliff findler bush is blooming out there, and I was hiking up Little Walnut about 10 days ago, and it's in bloom out there too. Apache plume is another very good pollinator one. Potentilla. And the trees, we didn't really go into the trees besides chokecherry, but desert willow is an excellent pollinator. New Mexico locust, soapberry, a lot of the oaks. Ash, I think I mentioned hop tree. Mexican elder is another nice one, and net leaf hackberry.
And so, Tricia, are all of these plants available at the farmer's market, either through Lone Mountain Natives or other folks?
I'll be honest with you. It is hard to find native plants, and we do have a lot of these available, but we're a small grower. So our hackberries, for example, they're in tree pots, and they're only 8 inches tall. You know, so a lot of these plants are available, but you really do have to search well to find them. The Gila Native Plant Society does a great plant sale in the spring, and we were actually one of their growers on that plant sale. But that's a good way to find native plants, is to contact your local native plant society and seek out the local growers, because it's always those small local growers at other farmers markets too who are usually dabbling in the local natives and growing those. And I mentioned Gavin, who also sells at Farmers Market. I know that Membris Farms does a lot of natives as well. And I'm sure that High Country Gals is doing some native growing as well.
So as a nursery owner, I'm sure you deal with a number of pests. And how can people manage pest issues, but in a way that is environmentally friendly?
So we deal with a lot of pests, because anytime you grow, here's a good example, 75 columbines all together, you know, in a confined space, you're going to have more pest issues. And I'm going to mention the one that's on everybody's mind right now, because I'm sure everybody has some of these in their yard right now. Aphids.
Aphids.
So
right.
A lot of people panic about the aphids, and you really shouldn't panic. If you discover them when there's just 10 to 20 on there, it's very easy to take a hose and just spray them off. Now, if you discover them, like in my situation, it can go from 10 to 20 to thousands of them, because I'm growing plants close together. What I try to do before that happens is I buy one of those big pump sprayer things, and I will put dish soap and a little bit of oil and say a 1 gallon or 2 gallon sprayer.
Oil,
and,
like vegetable oil?
Yeah, I'll just use a cheap vegetable oil, maybe a couple tablespoons of, say 2 tablespoons of dish. Well, I use Dr. Bronner's because it was recommended, but you could use other dish soap, I think. Mm-hmm. A couple tablespoons of that per 2 gallons and a tablespoon of oil, mix it up, and then just spray the aphids off with that. The oil kind of helps make the soap stick a little better.
Okay.
Now, for a seriously bad infestation, the thing is to try to get it before it's a really bad infestation, because it is difficult. Like if you've got a fruit tree with millions of aphids, it's difficult to spray them all off with a hose. But these are some of the ways you can manage. Of course, there's also releasing ladybugs, but the problem with ladybugs and other predatory insects is that they tend to disperse and fly away. So if you have a greenhouse and it's a problem in a greenhouse, that introducing ladybugs or something like that is much more effective.
Okay, let's take a short break and talk more about pollinators here on Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, and I'm your host for today's program. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about the importance of pollinators with Lone Mountain Natives co-owner Tricia Hurley. And Tricia, what can people be doing in their yards in terms of habitat and sort of making sure that our backyards are conducive, beneficial habitat to pollinators?
Okay, well, we already talked about some specifics and how to plant native and, you know, to incorporate different plants that are going to bloom at different times of the season and the structural habitat for trees and shrubs and the cacti and the yucca and all that. It's also important to remember to leave snags and to leave some leaf litter and logs, because these are going to provide nesting sites for native bees and other insects, and areas for them to larval stages to get under that leaf litter in the winter to protect them from cold and whatnot, provide shelter. We also want to think about, and I hadn't thought of this, leaving sections of bare or exposed soil, because they are important for ground nesting bees. And a lot of the native bees are ground nesting bees. Hmm. They also provide a place for other critters to, you know, tunnel in and lay eggs, other insects. And I just wanted people to think about the town of Silver City and all the gravel mulch we see around town at businesses, at many homes. There's not much habitat there. You know, often people put the weed cloth down and then they put all that gravel on top. And so you're limiting the ability for the insects to even access the ground. And think about if someone has a lot of blooming plants, but they have landscaping cloth and gravel, then they're not really providing for pollinators effectively because of all these other things we just mentioned, that you should have rotting logs and you should have leaf litter and you should have some bare exposed ground. So these are all part of the bigger picture of creating the habitat. It's not just a blooming flower that you want, mm-hmm. but you want the different heights and structure. You want all of this ground stuff.
So what should people use, if not gravel mulch? What are some mulches that people should be using?
Cardboard is a great mulch. And, you know, you can go and get refrigerator cardboard, washing machine cardboard, you know, from some of the places. So big, expansive pieces of cardboard are easy to work with. And the cardboard is actually a great mulch, and it decomposes, and there's nothing harmful in it. It's actually a great mulch that decomposes into the soil. So that's a good thing to use. And I just want to say, I think the weed cloth is appropriate for our median strips and places like that.
But or if you have Bermuda grass that you're trying to keep
down.
Oh,
yes, you would have to bring up Bermuda grass. That one is a tricky one. So, you know, years ago when we lived on Virginia Street, Mark actually dug up all the Bermuda grass, and he made this huge 4-foot-tall pile, and he just dug it up like carpet. But it does keep coming back. So,
yeah, it's hard to get rid of.
So, you know, getting rid of Bermuda grass may require a year or two of sheet mulching.
Right, right. Well, so let's shift gears, Tricia, and talk about some of the projects that are ongoing in the town of Silver City that are really trying to create pollinator-friendly habitat. And actually, I should say more than just Silver City, but Grant County. We've got the Silver Creek Botanical Garden.
Yeah, those are some of the ones I'd love to talk about.
But let's start with that one.
Yeah, Silver Creek Botanical Garden. Oh, gosh, it's been around now for at least 10 years. It was sort of taken over voluntary management by the Gila Native Plant Society. And Charles Holmes, I want to hats off to Charles. He worked with YCC out there 9 and 8 years ago, establishing a lot of the gardens. And I know my husband, Mark Cantrell, and a lot of the Aldo kids had put some of those initial cacti garden in out there. If you haven't been to Silver Creek Botanical Garden, it's across from the Virginia Street Park on Virginia Street, and it's definitely worth a visit. There's some very well-established gardens there, lots of pollinators coming to a lot of the plants that Charles established many years ago. And last year, we were awarded a Keep New Mexico Beautiful grant to put in a small pollination garden amongst the gardens already existing there in the shape of a butterfly. And this garden was a memorial garden to Ella, Ella, and Michael. And that garden is still young. We're hoping to put a few more plants in there and see how things do. But that's a great place to go see pollinators. And hats off to Gila Native Plant Society because their membership is out there watering the plants. They've received grants to put more plants in. And if you're interested in getting involved, contact the Gila Native Plant Society because they'd love to have more volunteers.
Yeah, it's a great, beautiful space.
It's a wonderful education garden. Yeah.
Absolutely. So there's also the Butterfly Way project out on the Gila River, and you've been actively involved in that.
At the Nature Conservancy property, and Patrice Muchnick and Carol Fugali are kind of spearheading that project. It's another wonderful area. I know Ella, Ella, and Michael used to love to go to the pond out there, especially Ella Jazz. And that garden is another garden that's in memory of them. And Aldo Leopold Middle School kids put in, close to 70 plants there in the winter a couple years ago. And I know they're doing very well. And we seeded the area extensively with Patrice and Carol. And I know I went out to see a lot of the seedlings are coming up, but I have not been back out there since January or February. There is a website, butterflyway.org, that you can go to learn more about that, how you could get involved, or maybe even to donate some money to help us create this wonderful pollination haven out there.
And you planted milkweed out there too, is that right?
We did. Carol and Patrice planted a bunch of the milkweeds we grew in the fall. In the late fall.
And what was the species?
We did horsetail milkweed and a lot of butterfly weed. So Asclepias tuberosa is the common one that a lot of people know. It's got the orange waxy looking flower. And then the horsetail milkweed is a little not as well known, but it's kind of a tall, knee-high plant that gets a creamy white flower on the top. And I'm glad you brought that one up because I wanted to point out there were so many times that we drove out to this Butterfly Way project last year, and I remember seeing all of that horsetail milkweed growing along 180 from, you know, Silver City to the Gila River area out there, and so much of it growing along, and then the mower would come and just cut it down. And I want to point out that I collected seed from horsetail milkweed across the street from the museum a couple years ago, and I noticed it in bloom because there was an bright orange butterfly flying all around it. And I went over there, and sure enough, there were caterpillars eating all of this horsetail milkweed. And I went back and collected seed in September, and a week later, I went back, and they'd weed whacked the entire area. But I just want to point out that a lot of these milkweeds, where they grow, they're often getting cut down as a weed. And they tend to look weedy until they bloom, but they're cut down even when they're blooming, whether it's because it's along the roadside where the mower goes. I've seen it blooming up near Corey caminos, the Mexican hat and the Western white yarrow bloom, and it's beautiful. And then I go by a week later and they've weed whacked it all down. So I think one of the points I'm trying to bring up is maybe we can encourage people not to constantly weed whack the things that don't need to be weed whacked. Like really, they're trying to go after the grasses and stuff, but it was easier for somebody to just weed whack the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Let's be selective mm-hmm. about how we do that.
Yeah. And speaking of roadways, I believe President Obama in Congress passed a huge bill to fund planting of milkweeds in the I-35 corridor between Texas and Duluth, Minnesota, because so many
migration pathway for the monarchs. Yes.
And so many of the milkweeds have disappeared. So there's this huge federal effort to get all of the federal agencies to partner, Department of Transportation on planting.
And Allison, we were discussing this just a little earlier about how farmers years ago were digging up the milkweeds, you know, for replacing with their crops and whatnot, and how in the 90s there was quite a campaign from Monsanto. Well, you were going into detail with me, so maybe you can...
Well, yeah, just to spray crops with Roundup, that of course impacted milkweed and
so
other
species. So they were
crops
that were genetically modified.
To be resistant
to
Roundup.
Exactly, and hence all the milkweeds that were growing along the sides were killed. And that's something to point out, is a lot of these milkweeds were growing as hedgerows or along the side of a lot of the cropland.
Or even inside the crops, too. Inside.
Yeah.
So
can I point out a quick fun milkweed story?
Go ahead.
So antelope horns is a great milkweed. I'm trying to remember, Asclepias speciosa? No, that's showy milkweed. Asperula. It's that one. And I've collected seed from the Walmart parking lot near the gas station up there. And every year I want to point out for people that think their milkweeds are dead, they have a big long taproot. They die to the ground. I kept going back to find this antelope horns and I thought it was dead. Well, it's in bloom right now and it came right back. In the winter, you can't find them at all. And then if we have time, is there any time to mention a couple other projects?
Oh, yeah. We were going to talk about the orchard here in the last couple minutes. So,
and then there's a couple others.
Yeah, we talked about the new orchard planted behind the Office of Sustainability and a couple Earth Matters shows ago. But Tricia, your Lone Mountain Natives provided some of the trees and plants.
We didn't provide any of the trees. I think those all came, I don't know, they were fruit trees from Grant County, Kendra. I'm not sure what the story was with those.
But you provided the native plants.
We provided some of the native plants. We provided a lot of pollination plants, actually. A lot of pollinating perennials were put out there from us.
And, of course, you'll need those pollinating plants to attract pollinators to pollinate the fruit trees.
I'm hoping that we can actually do more. That was a really neat collaborative effort between the city, Stream Dynamics, us, and other growers. Just two more that I want to mention, some Keep New Mexico Beautiful grants, and I want to give a thank you to them because they have helped us put in a lot of pollination gardens. The Rec Center, we're doing pollination gardens at the Rec Center, and also San Lorenzo School put a couple pollination gardens in this fall.
Excellent. Well, Tricia, this has been a great conversation about pollinators and how we can create more pollinator friendly habitats in our backyard. And I want to encourage everybody to get on down to the Silver City Farmers Market this Saturday, May 14th at 8:30 at the 7th Street and Bullard in downtown Silver City. So thanks so much, Tricia, for speaking with me today on Earth Matters. And that's
all the time
we have. Thank you to our audio engineer, Kyle Johnson. And we hope you'll join us again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio 89.1 FM.